I want you to imagine for a moment a beautiful countryside farm, complete with a large brick building, farm animals, vegetable crops and gardens, and even a bakery. Built as a refuge for lost souls, it was a place where those in need could find respite, a place where the community could house its less fortunate. Those who had no one to turn to, sometimes the elderly, families or orphaned children, those with disabilities, or really just anyone who was down on their luck and needed a warm, safe roof over their heads and food in their belly, could come to what was once called the old country home and find shelter and care. This was the idea behind the Rolling Hills Asylum, at least at first. But what began as a sanctuary for those in need soon devolved into madness, mayhem, and murder. Today, I'm taking you to one of the most haunted places in America, the Rolling Hills Asylum. Hello, everyone, and welcome back to Haunted History. I'm your host, Megan, and today we are going back to our roots, which isn't very far since we've only been around for about a year. But today's tale is a haunting. It's the haunting of an asylum with a very dark history. And I know how much we all love the asylum episodes. Now, I was able to talk to the owner of the asylum, Sharon, and I've invited her to have a chat with us on our after show, History After Dark, that will be available on Patreon. So stay tuned to our socials so you can catch all of those updates. Hopefully one day I will get to visit the asylum myself, but if you are in the East Bethany, New York region, you can stop by anytime. You can visit the official website, rollinghillsasylum.com, to learn about the ghost tours and all of the experiences that they have to offer. And honestly, even if you aren't heavily into the paranormal aspect, just being able to go and experience that kind of history would be pretty awesome. Okay, well, I think it's time. Let's get to today's story. The Rolling Hills Asylum is considered to be one of the most active paranormal locations on the East Coast of the United States. It's been featured in countless television programs, such as Ghost Adventures, Destination Fear, and BuzzFeed Unsolved. Today, it regularly accepts guests looking to uncover even more secrets and come face to face with one of the many spirits who have been seen or heard on the property. Rolling Hills was a place where denizens, orphans, and sick people commingled on a farm in upstate New York. It's estimated that around 1,700 people died during their stay at Rolling Hills and have been buried on the grounds. This place truly is the pinnacle of haunted history. Now, we've explored some asylums in previous episodes. You may recall places like Beechworth and Danvers, places where ghosts, metaphorical and literal, are said to roam the halls. But nothing quite compares to the place that I'm going to tell you about today. Truly, one of the most terrifying places in America, the Rolling Hills Asylum lives up to its reputation, at least according to the countless ghost hunters who pay it a visit. But what makes Rolling Hills outwardly creepy isn't just its paranormal presences. No. What makes Rolling Hills haunted is also its terrifying and sad social implications. When we hear the word asylum, we're typically flooded with countless negative thoughts. These places are not inherently seen as the places of care that some initially claimed to be. No. Instead, asylums make one think of forced confinement and death. These morbid thoughts don't come out of nowhere. History has indeed shown us that the people who lived in these type of places weren't actually taken care of in the proper sense. Indeed, instead of receiving healthy treatments for their ailments and afflictions, a safe space to eat and sleep, or any sort of affection that would make their days a little bit better, residents were often grossly mistreated, experimented on, and shown little to no compassion. Places like Rolling Hills Asylum kept them away from the outside world, which, at the time, is the only thing society cared about. In more ways than one, the residents of the asylums were brushed away. So what exactly happened at Rolling Hills? Before talking about what drove the asylum into infamy, let us delve into a bit of historical context first. The Rolling Hills Asylum conceptually took root in the cold winter months, and its austere beginnings gave us a glimpse into its eventual demise. Originally the site of a stagecoach tavern, the property was secured by the county to meet the demand to house, or perhaps hide, their less fortunate community members. And so the asylum was a publicly funded operation. To best accommodate the county's needs, it opted to build a poorhouse in the geographical center of the county. Rolling Hills first opened on January 1, 1827, near the hamlet of East Bethany, New York. During the early years of its operation, it was called the Genesee County Poor Farm. The building was a sprawling and imposing 53,000 square foot red brick house. It was built by the county as a place to welcome paupers. Poorhouses were common in the 19th and 20th centuries, especially in America. Outcasts, orphans, and the mentally and physically ill were generally discarded by society, and these so-called unwanted people were forced to gather in spaces built just for them, places like poorhouses. Except poorhouses weren't always built with the best of intentions. The origins of the poorhouse can be traced back to 17th century England. In England, municipalities were supposed to take care of the poorest members of the community, making a distinction between those who could take care of themselves and those who couldn't. Everyone was expected to work, and if you refused, you could be imprisoned. These houses were designed to make poverty unattractive. Those who couldn't provide for themselves would be sent to facilities like a poorhouse or a workhouse to live and work. They were essentially sentenced to hard labor just for being poor. The first American poorhouse popped up in Boston in the mid-17th century. It was a brick building intended to house dissolute and vagrant people. During this time, poor people could also be exiled from their village or even auctioned off to private bidders. By the early 19th century, some of these trends were still going strong. Poorhouses were being built in America within a larger framework designed to punish poor people. They perpetuated an extremely negative attitude toward the poor, and being poor continued to carry a negative social stigma. They were placed far away from view, a true case of out of sight, out of mind. Some poorhouses evolved into something called a poor farm. Much like poorhouses, these places were carefully regulated for poor people to live and work. But instead of performing industrial or domestic labor, they would do farm chores. Most poorhouses at this time also contained children. The Genesee County Poor Farm was no exception. Inside the walls of the facility, both children and criminals worked and slept next to each other on a daily basis. This type of cohabitation, as we'll find out, will prove most disastrous. In 1871, the cost of living on the farm was $1.08 a week per resident. Although that price was lower than the average rate for a poorhouse in America, that rate came with a catch. Everyone was expected to work outside, at least those physically able to. The Genesee County Poor Farm lay on a 200-acre property. It was sometimes referred to by locals as the Old Country Home, a completely self-sufficient working farm. It was surrounded by woods and, you guessed it, rolling hills. There, the residents took care of the pigs, the horses, and the chickens. Vegetable gardens and fruit crops were planted and picked. They even practiced canning jams, jellies, and meats. There was also a bakery and a wood shop. It's said that inmates built and sold wooden coffins to make some money. This fact alone is somewhat ominous and a tad creepy, if you ask me. On the surface, this arrangement would seem idyllic, especially as I just described. And this is really true if you consider that everyone who stayed at the farm more or less had nowhere else to go. So wasn't this better than the streets? It seemed like it was a pretty good life, considering the alternative. But unfortunately, that wasn't the case. Residents were always referred to as inmates, even if they weren't criminals, because at the farm, they weren't residents. They were workers. This is a further indication of their dehumanization. At the farm, residents were thought of as lost souls. Already they were seen as less than. Claims of horrific conditions soon began to surface. These claims can be more or less traced back to the construction of a stone building in 1828 that was meant to be a place that would isolate the asylum's misbehaving inmates. Already, the proposed model of the asylum wasn't functioning properly. Residents who were unable to care for themselves often ended up living in their own filth and were riddled with disease. Bedbugs infested everything and could even be seen crawling up the walls. Food was scarce, and often only soup and bread were offered, which meant that the residents had severe nutritional deficiencies. Up until 1887, people who were billed as lunatics were housed within the asylum's walls. As you can imagine, the proper understanding and care for people suffering from mental illness was far from befitting at the time. What's more, the ad hoc mix of people living at the asylum, widowed women, orphan children, those with drug and alcohol addictions, the mentally ill, and criminals, just to name a few, caused many incidents to occur between residents. Needless to say, I'm sure you can imagine the dynamics at play with all these different people being forced to cohabitate. Children were often abused. Women raped, the mentally ill physically assaulted and abused. Even murders were common. The residents were severely neglected and often faced significant health problems due to disease and sickness. What had originally been billed as a place of refuge was becoming a place of torment. This was made only the more significant because the asylum's residents had nowhere else to go, which created a sharp sense of despair and resignation. In 1938, a new building opened up. This building was meant to be an infirmary. As more sick people began entering the asylum, more and more began falling ill within its own walls, creating a vicious cycle of affliction. As a result, living conditions significantly plummeted. This wasn't uncommon within asylums, as we've seen in our previous episodes. It seems that the asylum model wasn't meant to sustain large numbers of so-called lost souls. One can presume that this was because the asylum was meant as a bandage on a bullet wound. A terrible reality began to befall the place, which, by 1950, was now called Rolling Hills Asylum. Children at the asylum experienced nothing of childhood. More often than not, they were put to work and made to put in long hours. It's also said that they were abused and had to bear witness or even experience things that they should have been protected from, such as violence inflicted upon others. And on top of all of this, they were living in close proximity with people that carried deadly diseases. Children were highly susceptible to contagion, and at the time, they were unaware that they were being exposed and highly at risk. The government felt that, for the children at least, living within the walls of Rolling Hills was better than living on the streets. But the truth was, however, that the asylum wasn't necessarily providing a life worth living for its resident children. In some cases, a life of abuse and neglect with no possibility of escape made life at Rolling Hills the worst option. The staff were overwhelmed, Residents were miserable, and the place that was first opened as a refuge became a nightmare. It's also alleged that many of the staff were incredibly cruel to the residents. Experimental procedures were believed to have been carried out on the mentally ill and disabled. The remains of medical equipment can still be seen to this day in the building. The Rolling Hills Asylum, it's said, is estimated to have around 1,700 deaths within its walls. Those who died on the property, it stands to reason, would have been buried on the property. Records of county proceedings dating from 1886 in regard to the asylum read, quote, "The burying ground we have improved by building a fence in front and grading and leveling the ground as much as could be done without injury to the graves." In the last 10 years of its operation, Rolling Hills served as a nursing home, but due to code violations, it was permanently closed in 1974. Today, the Rolling Hills Asylum is privately owned and is billed as the second most haunted site in the United States. The site offers tours and allows visitors the chance to experience their own supernatural encounters. After the facility closed, supernatural activity was documented by those who had spent time in the abandoned buildings. Some former residents that have made themselves known to visitors were spirits named Roy, George, Emma, Jack, and a mysterious screaming lady. Now, let's take a moment to hear their stories. Roy Krause was a man inflicted with gigantism. Gigantism is a condition where your anterior pituitary gland secretes too much growth hormone, and it makes you a bigger person than the average human by far. Gigantism, as you can imagine, was highly misunderstood in the past. Sadly, at the turn of the century, when he was just 12 years old, Roy's parents dropped him off at Rolling Hills. Young Roy had, of course, expected them to pick him back up at some point. What child wouldn't expect their parents to return? He was taken to the facility because of his incurable condition, and most likely because his parents were at a loss of how to best care for him. But, in truth, what could a mental asylum do? How were they going to help him? Roy must have been so scared and confused. And what's worse is that his parents never came back for him. He died in 1942 at the age of 52, having remained at Rolling Hills for the rest of his life. Even now, it's said that his presence, his absolute anguish, can still be felt. Roy was nearly 7.5 feet tall, and visitors and paranormal investigators have reported seeing a tall, 7-foot shadowy figure in the hallways. However, Roy is considered a gentle spirit within the walls of the asylum. George Fleming was the superintendent. He passed away from a stroke in his room. People report hearing coughing when no one else is around. Many believe that the coughs belong to George, still coughing from beyond the grave. Emma is the spirit of a former nurse who was very dedicated to her job. She's mostly seen and felt and heard inside her room. In the tunnels underneath the property, the spirit of a young boy has communicated with visitors. He likes to play with people. People have reported hearing him laughing and have felt him touching their legs and clothing to get their attention. Despite the tunnels being such an ominous location, people have confessed to feeling a childlike and non-threatening energy while down there. And then there's the screaming lady. There's a theory as to who she is, but no one really knows her true identity. Some people believe it could be Phoebe White, the very first resident who moved in when she was only a little girl, back when it was a poorhouse. She lived there for 56 years. Many believe that the screams they hear are her trying to communicate with visitors. Her frustrated screams have been picked up on multiple ghost hunting devices and can be heard by the naked ear. There are some other haunted locations on the property. In the aptly named Shadow Hallway, located on the second floor of the East Wing, people have documented seeing many shadowy figures. The figures vary from a dark black to a pale gray color. Sometimes only an appendage appears, such as a leg or an arm. Creepily, these disembodied limbs have been seen walking upright like a person and even crawling on the floor. They can be amorphous shapes or human-like. These appearances are said to occur between the hours of 3 a.m. and 5 a.m. On the building's second floor, many visitors have reported hearing footsteps and sliding from above. This is especially chilling since there isn't a third floor. In the basement, there's a room known as the Christmas Room. During its operation, there were many children who enjoyed spending time down there. During the Christmas holiday, there was a room where all of the kids could go and meet Santa Claus. The room still has Christmas decorations up all around it, and people have reported seeing toys move by themselves. According to the website Haunted America, one of the most talked-about haunted occurrences happened to Susie Yenser, who was a tour guide at the property. In September of 2007, Susie was touring the property when a man said that he wanted to attempt to film some paranormal activity. Susie agreed to escort him to the Christmas room. There, all the lights were turned off and the man put down a pink glow stick along with some toys. These objects were placed at the center of the dark room in a circle. It should be noted that at the time there were other tour guests that were gathered at the scene watching. Susie then began communicating with the spirits, and it's said that the temperature of the room dropped sharply. The pink glow stick began immediately moving back and forth. Guests then said that they began seeing a disembodied hand, an arm, reach out for the toys, a ball, and a small rocking horse. This unexplained paranormal phenomena is said to have been witnessed by the whole group touring the site that day, and no definitive explanation for what they had witnessed had ever been produced. The basement also holds a psychiatric ward and solitary confinement cells. Inside, the cells still have the shackles that were used to restrain the residents. If you visit the morgue today, you can still see the embalming table that was used and the large refrigerators that they used to store corpses. Visitors report hearing disembodied voices and poltergeist activity in this room. Some people have even been shoved by a mysterious, invisible force. Subtle touching and loud screams, like a mother crying for her child, have also been heard in this part of the building. As I said earlier, there is reported to be a cemetery somewhere on the property, but its exact location is still unknown. There is no site map and no burial record, but it's believed that 1,700 people died on the property in its long history. The wood shop not only made coffins for the local community, but it also provided coffins for those who died at Rolling Hills. It's believed that the residents who died with no family or friends to claim them were buried in unmarked graves. Now, those graves remain unmarked and unkempt. One of the biggest tragedies of Rolling Hills Asylum is that even in death, these lost souls were forgotten. A memorial site was created in the Genesee County Park on June 6, 2004. This is when five headstones, dated from 1887 to 1888, were returned to the county. The Genesee County historians dedicated a historical marker honoring those who died while living at the poorhouse from 1827 until the facility was closed in 1974. The current owner, Sharon Coyle, has opened the facility up for visitors to explore. She shared with Haunted History a chilling experience of her own.
We were set up on the far side of Shadow Hallway, right outside the solarium where Jack paces back and forth, behind the closed doors. We were facing the west wing ramp and infirmary about 150, 200 foot distance, I'm guessing. We had all been hearing noises, footsteps, sounds of furniture moving, distant voices, seeing shadows, all the usual activity, including hits on the mag lights and millimeter. I used to be the type of person who would take 300 to 500 photos a night on investigations. But owning RHA, it's impossible to keep up with evidence, let alone have a large enough hard drive store all of it. So now I tend to enjoy and focus in on my personal experiences and use my camera and recorder judiciously. That being said, we kept seeing so many shadows passing back and forth across the infirmary doorway, heading down the hallway towards us, that when it became super dark, I started clicking off a few photos, pretty confident that I was seeing Roy Krause, our 7-foot shadow man. I encountered Roy for the first time on my first visit to RHA on June 12, 2008. He's been my favorite ever since. We seem to have a special connection. I often receive EVPs from him and also clear conversations, using my Frank's box number 87. I believe that Roy was showing himself that evening in response to the earlier activities in RHA. I think he was letting me know all was A-OK, and all of Rolling Hills' spirits were feeling safe again.
The Rolling Hills Asylum was the background to suffering for a century. Its walls were filled to the brim with people in their most vulnerable and disaffected state. Residents were mistreated by staff and each other. It was a place where the poor and misfortunate were essentially sent to rot away. Today, remnants of that suffering can still be felt. Rather, it's through the ghosts that lurk in the hallways or the overwhelming emotions that people claim to feel when walking around the buildings. Rolling Hills Asylum is active in one way or another. One thing is for sure, most of the people who once called that place home deserved better. Does Roy still roam the halls, waiting for his parents to come take him home? And what about George or Emma or Jack? Rolling Hills now operates as a paranormal research center, offering ghost and historical tours to the public. Like most places that have a reputation for being haunted, you may not ever know until you experience something there yourself. The residents of the Rolling Hills Asylum, it seems, had nowhere to go, both in life and in death. And perhaps it serves them well to be remembered and for us to keep talking about their stories so that they may find some sort of solace and be honored in our remembering. Well, that's it for us today. We hope you enjoyed this episode on the Rolling Hills Asylum, and we want to extend a very big thank you to Sharon for being involved in our episode today, and we will see you all next time on Haunted History.